Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
We are starting in Micah chapter 3 tonight. That is the beginning of the second message of the book of Micah, and it takes up the next three chapters. I'm going to try to cover all three chapters tonight because they're not long and they're not difficult, really. Chapter 3 is a denunciation against the heads of Israel, the leaders in Israel, and then Micah turns his attention against the prophets of Israel. What you're going to see is, across the board, the problem with both the prophets and the leaders is greed and the fact that they prefer those who have money and will support them, and that they are consistently against the poor, those who cannot benefit them. It's a theme that we have seen a lot as we have looked through the prophets. But then, starting in chapter 4, it's about these last days again and about restoration for Israel and about regathering of Israel. So it's very consistent with what we've seen from all the prophets, God pouring out judgment against Israel. And in particular, Micah talks not only about Israel, the northern tribes, and the Assyrian captivity, but he's also going to talk about the Babylonian captivity, which is really fascinating. We'll get into that a little bit tonight. And then, of course, chapter 5 is how do you make that transition from you are a people who are under God's judgment to you are a people who are going to be blessed and regathered and redeemed. Something has to happen between the failure of Israel and the restoration of Israel, and really that's what chapter 5 explains. There's a lot of poetic language here, but not difficult to understand language. In chapter 3, verse 1, "And I said, hear now, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice?" In other words, that's the expectation, is that you're going to rule with justice. You're going to rule according to the law of God. "You who hate good and love evil." And then he's going to describe the way that they treat people as devouring them, as ripping the flesh off their bones and making a stew in a pot with their bones. Very descriptive language of how it is that they oppress and misuse the poor. "You hate good and you love evil, who tear off their skin from them and their flesh from their bones, who eat the flesh of my people, who strip off their skin from them and break their bones and chop them up as in a pot and as meat for the kettle." And yet, despite the fact that that's how you treat the people of God, the people who you are supposed to be treating justly, even though you are so deeply involved in your sin, in your abuse of these people, nevertheless, verse 4 says, "And then you cry out to Yahweh, like I'd be on your side after you do all that. You cry out to the Lord, but he will not answer them. Instead, he will hide his face from them at that time because they have practiced evil deeds." So that's the leaders, and he's going to return to denouncing these leaders, but now he turns his attention to the prophets. See if any of this sounds familiar. "Thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets who lead my people astray. When they have something to bite in their teeth," in other words, when it benefits them, when they get some food, when it benefits them, then they say peace. They say good things. "Just give me money and I'll tell you good things. I'll tell you that God thinks you're a handful of aces. I'll be one of those teachers that you can trust to scratch your itching ears. Just pay me enough. So when they have something to bite with their teeth, then they cry peace. But against him who puts nothing in their mouths, against those who don't give them money, don't support them, well, then they declare holy war. So the difference is distinct. The difference is between peace with God or God is against you, and it's not based on the law or based on behavior or based on holiness. It's based on how much money they can afford to give the prophet. If you pay the prophet enough, he'll tell you good stuff. If you don't put anything in his mouth, well, then he'll tell you God's against you. Therefore, yes, that does sound familiar, doesn't it? Yeah, I thought it might. Therefore, it will be night for you without vision. In other words, even though they're the prophets, they're not going to hear from God. They're not going to see visions from God. It's going to be darkness for you without divination. The sun will go down on the prophets, and the day will become dark over them. The seers will be ashamed, and the diviners will be embarrassed. Indeed, they will all cover their mouths because there is no answer from God. So the same way that God said to the leaders that when they cry out to him, he would not answer them, hear now when the prophets expect to hear from God, there's going to be nothing. There's going to be darkness for them and no answer from God. Which, by the way, shows you that a sovereign God can pick and choose and is under no obligation to speak to anybody. He doesn't have to tell people anything just because they demand answers from him. You have to approach him on his terms. You have to approach him reverently, and he will reveal to you what he wants to reveal to you based on what is most beneficial to him. And so you can't just burst into the presence of that God and start demanding answers. He's under no compunction or obligation to tell you anything. On the other hand, says verse 8, this is now Micah speaking because he's a true prophet. On the other hand, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of Yahweh, and with justice and courage to make known to Jacob his rebellious act, even to Israel his sin. So even though the false prophets for enough money will tell you, oh, it's all peace, it's good with God, don't worry about it, everything's good, the true prophets, like Micah, like Jeremiah, like most of the prophets we've seen, despite the fact that the people and the leaders have resisted them, the true, genuine prophets who hear from God have to say what God has told them to say. They are filled with power from God to tell Israel what God's word is, and you will notice that that word is usually, you're guilty. And that is still to this very day, again, another parallel when you just say what the Bible says about human beings and you tell them they're corrupt and you talk about total depravity. They don't want to hear that. When you say you have sinned continuously against a righteous and holy eternal God, people don't want to hear that. Instead, they want to be able to justify themselves, and they will spend money on a church that will tell them they're just fine. Am I talking about Joel Osteen right now? But anyways, if you want a big church, just be willing to tell people that everything's fine, everything's good. But if you say what the Bible says, or if you say what God said through the prophets, you have to tell, in this case, Jacob, that he's rebellious, and you have to inform Israel of his sinfulness. And if you're being truly biblical, you have to tell people of their sinfulness before a righteous and a holy God. Anyway, verse 9, now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob. So again, he has returned his attention to the leaders of the house of Jacob and the rulers of the house of Israel, you who abhor justice and twist everything that is straight. You might remember back in verse 1 of chapter 3, when Micah identified the leaders, the first thing he said is it not meant for you. I'm going to add the word meant for clarification. But isn't it meant for you to know justice? Isn't that what your job is? To hand out righteous rulership, to judge according to God's standard? Isn't that what your assignment is? And yet here, he identifies them as you who abhor, hate justice. And you twist everything that's straight. The law of God is straight and righteous and holy and put out in front of you. So of course you're going to twist that. You're going to bend that because that doesn't suit people and they're not going to bring you more money. You who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with a violent injustice. Her leaders pronounce judgment for a bribe. Her priests instruct for a price. And her prophets divine for money. So across the board, the problem is greed and the problem is money. And yet, despite that, despite their rebellion, despite their abhorrence of the justice of God, despite that, in the midst of calamity or problems or trouble, you lean on Yahweh, saying, is not he Yahweh in our midst? So calamity can't come on us. So they think that they're going to continue to sin with impunity as if there is no justice, as if there is no judgment awaiting them. Does that also sound familiar? Because that's very much the society, the rebellious society that we are living with to this very day, that believes that there is no judgment, that there ultimately is no calamity awaiting them. They're just going to live their lives according to their own rebellious ways, and there's never going to be a day of comeuppance. So they lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? Calamity will not come upon us. Therefore, on account of you, notice the you there. They, as the head of Israel, because of their sin, all of Israel collectively is going to be punished. So then Zion, all of the people, are going to be plowed as a field. And Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the temple will become high places of a forest. So it's going to become overgrown. The land is not going to be properly cared for. And the magnificent buildings and structure that was once Jerusalem is all going to be plowed to the ground. And yet, immediately after that prophecy of destruction and how God is going to judge them and how it is going to be a destruction against Israel collectively because of their leaders, despite that, the very next thing we read, remember there's no chapters here. Micah did not then write chapter 4. Instead, the very next thing he said was, and it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord, that very mountain that's going to be overgrown like the places of a forest, that very same mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of all the high places of all the mountains. It will be raised up above the hills, and the peoples, all the peoples, all the nations, the Gentiles, the Goy, will then stream to it. So immediately after the prophecy of utter destruction, Micah then talks about this glorious day of restoration that's coming for Jerusalem, which I think is supposed to be an inspiration to the people he's talking to, that God himself is faithful to them. God hasn't changed. God knows the promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God knows that this is the place where he has chosen to place his name. God knows that Jerusalem is the place where his kings have been and where his worship has been. And he is faithful to his people and to his land, which should be an inspiration to these rebellious people to return to God. Because after all, Yahweh has this glorious plan for you. It will come about when? Well, in the last days. Not now. Right now you're going to be punished. In fact, he's going to predict for them the next several hundred years of punishment coming to them. But in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised up above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. And many nations will come and say, that's many Gentiles, will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the house of the God of Jacob. Notice that even in the last days, God will still be identified as the God of Jacob. It doesn't sound like he's planning to be done with them once and for all. So let's go up to the house of the God of Jacob so that he may teach us about his ways and so that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion, from Jerusalem, will go forth the law, even the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many peoples. He'll be the judge, the God, the leader, not only over Israel, but over all the people groups of the earth. And he will render decisions for mighty distant nations. And then they will hammer their swords into plowshares. So now we know the time period he's talking about. He's talking about a time that has not occurred yet where there's going to be peace all over the world, no more warfare, when you're not going to need the implements of war anymore, and so you're going to use those for agricultural purposes. You're going to hammer your swords into plowshares. And you're going to take your spears and you're going to make them into pruning hooks. Because nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Now, if we compare that with what we've been reading on Sunday morning out of Matthew 24 and Luke 21, that is when Jesus said, now these are the signs before I come, there will be wars and there will be rumors of war. That's the time we live in right now. That's this time of the Gentiles, this time of upheaval, this time of trouble. But notice that he says that there is a time that he identifies as the last days. And in that time, nation will not lift up sword against nation. It's the absolute inverse of what Jesus has been describing to us on Sunday mornings. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Now, I told you last week in the introduction to the book of Micah that he was a contemporary of Isaiah. They were both prophesying around the same period of time to the same people group. Turn over to Isaiah 2 for just a moment. Because Isaiah 2, the first four verses, are pretty much identical to what we just read at the beginning of chapter 2 of Micah. Now, you can read commentary after commentary, and they'll try to give you reasons why both of them say the exact same thing here. Some will say that Micah copied Isaiah. Some will say Isaiah copied Micah. I prefer to believe that it's because they were both speaking for the same God. And that same God presented the same message to his true prophets. And as a consequence, they both said the same thing. Isaiah chapter 2, the word which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Israel. Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of Yahweh will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. And all nations will stream to it, and many peoples will come and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, so that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. So pretty much identical prophecies coming from two prophets who were both prophesying at the same period of time to the same people group, to the same series of kings. So what do you think the chances are that that's actually going to be? That's actually going to come to fruition in time and history and geography. What are the likelihoods that that's going to happen? Well, what we know is Isaiah accurately predicted Cyrus, the Persian king, named him by name 150 years in advance. What we're going to see in a moment is that Micah is going to accurately predict that Judah is going into the Babylonian captivity. Micah is prophesying somewhere between 740 and 700 BC about an event that wouldn't happen till 586 BC. There's roughly 120 years in between. And yet he's accurately going to describe the punishment that God is going to bring down on Judah. In other words, both Isaiah and Micah have demonstrable historic proof that what they said came true. And so if both of them say the same thing, I got to go with, well, that's going to happen. I mean, they've got a really good batting average going. So if both of them say that there is a time coming when judgment for all the nations is going to come from Israel, when the flowing of the nations to learn about God and his holiness and his righteousness, his law and his standards is going to require that they come to Jerusalem to learn about the God of Jacob, and that there's going to be this great time of peace where nation does not fight against nation anymore. We have not seen that in human history before, but I do believe that it absolutely has to happen, and it fits very neatly with the eschatology that we already believe. We're back to Micah chapter 4. Verse 4, in describing this time of peace and describing this time when the law will go forward from Zion and when the word of the Lord is going to come from Jerusalem in order to judge many peoples, distant nations, once mighty distant nations. Once there is peace across the board, then each of them will sit under his own vine, under his own fig tree, with no one to make them afraid. That's a picture of leisure. That's a picture of being at peace, not being afraid. Why? For the mouth of Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, the God of armies, has spoken it. That's why we know it's going to happen. Because he said it. And he said it through two of his prophets now. He is predicting this time of peace to come. Now, in the Old Testament, we see Daniel, we see Jeremiah talk about this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. And then Jesus confirms it. That's what we've been seeing in Matthew 24 on Sunday mornings. Jesus confirms that what the prophets of the Old Testament, in that case two of them, they said there's a time of trouble coming. Jesus confirms, yes, that's coming. But then there's also this time of peace coming. There's this time of restoration coming. And it's more than just the regathering of Israel. It is the time when the blessings of God come down through Jerusalem out to the Gentile nations, and proper righteous justice and judgment come from Jerusalem, because after all, the king is sitting in Jerusalem. And two prophets in the Old Testament said that. That also has to happen. So the same way that I'm firmly convinced and firmly believe that this time of Israel's trouble and Israel's judgment is coming, I equally believe that the time of Israel's restoration and them being lifted up above all other nations is coming. Because that's what it says. And in the midst of what it says, it also says that God said this is going to happen. Therefore, if you say, well, no, it's not, God's done with Israel, you're now speaking directly in contradiction to what God not only said, but then pointed out that he said. Each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree with no one to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. And though all the peoples right now, currently, you look at the nation, you look around the world, though all the peoples walk each in the name of his own God, right now, as Micah is speaking, as he is prophesying, he is saying, right now, there's this whole plethora of gods, and all the different people groups, all the different nations, all the different goyim, they all have their own gods, and they follow after their gods, they walk after their gods. But as for us, as for Israel, as for us, we walk in the name of Yahweh because he is God forever and ever. And ultimately then, based on what he has just described, God's law is going to come from Jerusalem out to all the goyim, out to all the nations, out to all the Gentiles. So Micah is admitting right now the nations of the world follow their own gods. They go their own ways. They worship their own stuff. But the day is coming of universal peace on the planet. And in order for that to happen, the real God, the God of Jacob, the God of Israel, has to establish his kingdom in Jerusalem. And then righteousness will finally come on the earth and peace will finally be on the whole earth. And everyone will recognize and have to come to Jerusalem and say, come on, we got to go let the God of Jacob teach us. So there is this time coming of a universal recognition of Yahweh, who even in those days is identified as the God of Jacob. Have I said anything yet the Bible doesn't say?
No.
Okay. In that day, when that happens, declares Yahweh, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcasts, even those whom I have afflicted. That's such interesting language. Talk about a sovereign God. He's talking about the lame and the outcasts, and then he says, and I'm the one that afflicted them. Sure, they have afflictions, yeah, but I'm in charge of everything, so I afflicted them. And because I'm the one who's in charge of afflicting them, I can also heal them, I can also gather them, and I can also make them part of my eternal community. I will make the lame a remnant. I will make the outcasts a strong nation. I can do whatever I want. I can regather my people and make them a mighty nation. And Yahweh will reign over them in Mount Zion. There's that language again. It's not, as is so often allegorized, the promises of God for a future of Israel are not promises that are meant to be fulfilled in eternity in the sky. The language continually is on Mount Zion, a locatable place on earth in the Middle East that has always been the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so he says, the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever, continually after that. As for you, Tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come. It's interesting. He's talking now to the land itself, which he has said is going to be destroyed, is going to be overrun, is going to be overgrown like a forest, is going to be razed to the ground, and yet there is this glorious time of restoration coming for the hill of Zion, the place that towers over the people of God. The hill of the daughter of Zion. To you, all these promises I am making you will come. Even the former dominion will come. Once upon a time, during the time of David and during the time of Solomon, when they were the chief nation in the Middle East there, it's going to be like that. In fact, it's going to be greater than that. Even the former dominion will come. The kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Okay, so since 70 AD, when the temple fell, and when Judah was scattered, when all of Israel was then out of their land until 1948, and since 1948 and the regathering of some Jews back to the land of Israel, can we say that they, at this point, have any sort of actual dominion over the Gentile nations, or that they are the kingdom of Jerusalem. Can we say that?
No.
No. In fact, does Jerusalem have a king right now?
No.
No. In fact, the leader of Jerusalem is a prime minister right now. But there is going to be a kingdom on the hill that we know as Mount Zion, where the temple used to be. There's going to be a king, Christ himself, who's going to sit on his throne from Jerusalem, and the Gentile nations are going to flow to him to come learn wisdom and justice. So now, since you know all that, since you know that that's your future, now why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you? Why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you, or has your counselor perished? That agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth. There's that language that we see over and over again. That time of punishment, any time that God puts punishment on his people, any time they are under his judgment, he compares it to a woman in childbirth. And yet he says, writhe and labor and give birth, daughter of Zion. So what's he talking about? He's saying, let this work that I'm doing in you, let this punishment that I'm putting you through do its work. It's going to be painful, but there is going to be an end result. There is going to be childbirth. You are going to reach the end of it. So writhe and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. And now you will go out of the city and dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. What? He's talking during a time where the Assyrian captivity is just sort of beginning. Assyria's making its early encroachments into northern Israel. But now he's talking about the Babylonian captivity that, as I said, is not going to happen for another 120 years. But did it happen?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly the way that it was predicted to happen. So dwell in the field and go to Babylon, and there, while you're in Babylon, there you're going to be rescued. Did that happen? Yeah, 70 years they were in Babylon, and then they were brought back, and then they rebuilt the temple and rebuilt the city walls again, because from there the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. So I think Micah is saying that to say, you're going to see demonstrations of God punishing you and restoring you. You're going to see him do this. You're going to see him put you through a time of labor and pain and hardship, but it's going to end. It's going to come to its fruition, and there is going to be redemption, and there is going to be regathering, and there is going to be rebuilding, and that's going to happen. So when you see that, remember the promise that there is this time of peace coming, this time at the end when Jerusalem is going to be established as the chief hill, because that is the pattern of God. Remember the pattern of God in dealing with you as a people group, that he punishes you, he corrects you, and he redeems you. He never leaves you altogether. He never makes a complete destruction of you, but he will teach you. He won't leave you guiltless. He will instruct you. He will teach you according to his holiness and his law, but he won't let you go. So the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. And now many nations have been assembled against you, who say, this, by the way, is apparently the Assyrians, who, as I said, are now descending on the northern tribes. Many nations have assembled against you, and they say, let her be polluted, and let our eyes gloat over Zion. Are you getting whiplash yet from these gigantic leaps from Mount Zion, the kingdom of Zion, to destroyed Zion? But that's because God is developing his pattern. This is how I'm going to deal with you. But they, I find this fascinating, but these nations who each walk after their own gods, who don't know the God of Israel, they say, let Israel be polluted, And they say, let our eyes gloat over Zion, over Jerusalem. But they do not know the thoughts of Yahweh, which is why I've been trying to drive this. God creates patterns. God has thoughts that are not the way we think. They don't know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his purpose. He has a purpose. He is using those Gentile nations to punish his people. But what else is the pattern that we see consistently? He then punishes the nations that he uses to punish his people. They don't know that. They don't see that happen. They don't know the mind of the Lord or the universal sovereignty of God who uses people groups in order to accomplish his own plan for his people. They do not understand his purpose. For he, those nations, those people who think that they're destroying Jerusalem for their own sake and their eyes are gloating over Zion, well, then he, God, is going to gather them like sheaves to a threshing floor and then say, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. So he's going to use Jerusalem and Israel to punish the people who he used to punish Israel. That's a very, very sovereign, hard-to-grasp God, but that's how he describes himself and goes through the trouble of saying, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways, and the Gentile nations don't understand how I am. But while they're busy gloating, I'm going to use you to thresh them like sheaves on a threshing floor. So arise and thresh, daughter of Zion. For your horn, your power, I will make iron. And your hoofs, I will make bronze, so that you pulverize many peoples, many Gentile nations. So that you may devote to Yahweh their unjust gain, and their wealth will come to the Lord of all the earth. The Gentile nations don't get that. I don't think Israel, for the most part, gets that, even though they've got prophets trying to explain it to them. Look, this is a pattern that God works, and there is an ultimate restoration coming. And along the way, he is going to continue to provide for you, and then he's going to turn around and punish you. But then he's going to redeem you, then he's going to regather you. And there is an end to that when all of this childbirth pain, when all of this agony that you go through is finally going to come to its fruition, and you're going to finally give birth, and there's going to be this glorious end to it. And that's the way that God works. And he is going to use Israel ultimately to pulverize the nations of the earth, so that the nations of the earth come to Zion to learn about the God of Israel. That's the master plan. And then they're going to bring all the wealth of those nations to the Lord of all the earth. How is that going to happen? So in my introduction tonight, I said, between the leaders of Jerusalem are evil and corrupt and unjust, and they hate righteousness, and even the prophets are willing to prophesy for money, but if you don't give them anything, don't put anything in their mouth, then they're going to tell you that God hates you. And yet these people are going to be ultimately redeemed and regathered, and they have this glorious future of peace ahead of them. So how do they get from enemies of God to the eternally favored of God? How do they make that transition? Well, that's chapter 5. Now muster yourselves into troops, daughter of Zion. In other words, be ready to fight. Muster yourself into troops because they have laid siege against us. And with a rod, they will smite the judge of Israel. That word can also be the king of Israel. They will smite him on the cheek. By the way, that was the greatest indignity there was between kings. If you could bring a king down and use a reed and slap him across the face, that was a way of showing, I completely dominate you. And that actually happened to Zedekiah at this point, as Israel was being crushed by the Assyrians. That Zedekiah was completely taken off his throne and shown to be powerless. I think that's what Micah is describing here. And yet, but as for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me, God speaking, to be the ruler in Israel. So even though the last of your kings gets destroyed, there's a king coming. The king that's coming is going to be the king that God himself sets up in Jerusalem to establish this kingdom and establish the peace that I've already told you is coming. That's how you're going to go from enemies and haters of God and his righteousness. That's how you're going to transition into this time of great peace, is I'm going to send you the ultimate judge. I'm going to send you the ultimate king. He's going to come from Bethlehem. From you, one who will go forth from me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago. So he's not just an earthly king. He is a heavenly, eternal king. His going forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. And then the remainder of his brethren, that's the rest of Israel, after they have gone through their ultimate punishment, after they have endured it and reached the point of childbirth, then he is going to establish peace among them, and he's going to gather them. Here's this language of gathering again. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. Not only has God not forgotten Israel, who he has scattered, remember that he's writing during the beginning of the Assyrian captivity, and he's saying, this captivity that you're in is going to continue until the time that all of this punishment that you're going through, all these trials, all these judgments from God, you're going to go through all of those until you give birth, until you come to the culmination of them all. And when that happens, you're all going to be regathered again because I'm going to set up a king for you in Jerusalem, a king who is actually eternal. He will arise and he will shepherd his flock in the strength of Yahweh. That, by the way, is what the judges and the leaders in Israel weren't doing. They weren't shepherding. They were getting rich. They were getting fat and happy off the backs of people. They were getting paid. They weren't being the shepherds that they were called to be. But ultimately, he will be the shepherd of his flock. By the way, who is his flock in this context?
Israel.
Because he said his brethren. Then, when he is on his throne, that great king, then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel, and he will arise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name, of the authority of the Lord his God. And they will remain, and they will be established, is what that word means. Israel will remain in their land, be established, just like we just read. They're going to have this time of peace, and there's going to be no more war, and nation isn't going to rise up against nation, and the Gentile nations are going to flow to Jerusalem to learn about the God of Israel and the God of Jacob. They will remain there. They will be steadfast there, because at that time, he will be great to the ends of the earth, because the Lord God himself is sitting on the throne and ruling over the ends of the earth. And he will be great to the very ends of the earth, and he will be our peace. That answers the question, how do they go from rebels against God to having this time of glorious peace and restoration? What has to happen between those two events? What has to happen between enemy of God and redeemed of God? There has to be someone to come in and make restitution and make peace between those two parties, between God and men. And that's the way it has always been. Now here, it is put in the context of the glorious promises that are given to Israel. He's the one who's going to come and establish his kingdom, and he is the one who is going to bring peace. He is the very one who will be the peace of Israel. He is the one who's going to bring about this glorious time on planet Earth. But it's the same for us. We are also rebels against God. We're just naturally depraved. We're born in sin, naturally. And yet, I think all of us would say that we're looking forward to the time of heavenly glory and being gathered and marriage supper of the Lamb, all this good news, all this good stuff that we're anticipating. So how did we get from rebellious enemies of God to having peace and marriage supper of the Lamb and being the bride of Christ? How did that happen? Because it was Christ in the middle. Christ came and made the difference from what we were to what's going to be. Same thing for Israel. And people far too often say, Christ is the deciding factor for us Christians. But Micah says the exact same way that you have experienced your rebellion versus the blessed hope because of him, it's the same way Israel has gone through times of trouble and times of punishment and times of scattering. And yet there is this time of ultimate restoration and a forever king. And that happens because Christ, yet again, in the middle. So then how can people say, that applies to me? That applies to the Gentile church, 21st century. It applies to us, but it doesn't apply to them. It doesn't apply to Israel. And yet Micah first described it within the context of Israel. The Gentile church isn't going to be for another 700 plus years. And yes, they're going to be redeemed the same way, but those promises of restoration belong first to Israel, which is why Paul would say that the gospel goes to the Jew first and also to the Gentile, because it is good news to Israel, reaffirming to them that God, through Christ, is still going to keep all his promises to Israel. And oh yeah, we're going to include Gentiles. And yet now we think Gentiles get the supremacy and God is done with Israel. And that's incredibly backward thinking. The very next thing we see is when the Assyrian invades our land. Okay, now this is talking most likely about the Assyrian captivity, which, like I said, was just beginning at that moment. And yet there's language included here that didn't happen during the Assyrian captivity, that seems to be looking forward out into the future. I remember years ago, I mean a lot of years ago, that I heard a prophecy preacher who I had some respect for at the time. And he said, according to Micah, the final Antichrist is referred to as that Assyrian. It is a thing that Micah does here where he's going to comment on this personage, this character who he calls the Assyrian. Now, I do not ascribe to the idea that the Antichrist or the little horn, the final world leader prior to Christ, needs to necessarily be from Assyria, but boy, wouldn't that be interesting if he was, because that would be out of the Seleucid portion of the ancient Alexandrian kingdom, and that actually fits with everything else we believe. I hope you understood all that language I just flew through. But look what he does. That Assyrian tramples on our citadels, and then he will raise against him. We, Israel, will raise against him seven shepherds and eight leaders of men. In other words, for everybody they send to fight against us, we're going to send 15 to go fight against them. So we're going to overwhelm them with our power. That hasn't happened. That didn't happen during the original Assyrian captivity. They will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword. In the land of Nimrod, they're going to shepherd at its entrances, and he will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. That hasn't happened yet. Now, this may be talking in a very big overview of history that the Assyrian captivity, which was happening as Micah was writing, that he may be saying there's going to be an end of it. At this time when God gives you the power, Israel, Jerusalem, to trample on your enemies, as he just described, that perhaps at that time there's going to be overwhelming power against Assyria, except that Assyria doesn't exist anymore. So then some commentators say, well, since they said the land of Nimrod too, since they brought him up and mentioned him as the god of those people, and since he was a god of ancient Persia as well, that may be referring to Persia, which is modern day Iran, which is really, really interesting considering the day that we're living in at this very moment. But what this all seems to be in combination is a description of, yes, the Assyrian has absolutely trampled us, but the day is coming, in keeping with everything else that Micah has said in these couple of chapters, the day is coming when Israel is going to trample the Assyrian. The day is coming when God is going to turn on Assyria and use Israel to trample down those nations that worshiped Nimrod. And he, God, will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. Then the remnant of Jacob will be among the peoples, will be among the Goyim, will be scattered among the nations. Like dew from Yahweh, like showers on vegetation, which don't wait for man or delay for the sons of men. We're not in control of what happens with the dew or the rain. And God says here that when it comes to the remnant of Jacob, he's not waiting on men. He doesn't care what men think. He's not waiting to find out what people think. He's going to do it the same way he does the rain and the dew. The remnant of Jacob will be among all the nations, among many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, which, if he passes through, if a lion passes through among the sheep, he tramples them down and he tears them up. And there is none to rescue the sheep from a lion. And he compares Israel to that. So this day is coming when Israel is going to be a powerful force and they are going to be scattered among the nations, but they are going to be the force that God uses to take those nations down. Your hand will be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies will be cut off. It will be in that day, declares the Lord, that I will cut off. He's now speaking to the Gentile nations, that I will cut off your horses from among you and destroy your chariots. And I will also cut off the cities of your land and tear down your fortifications. I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you will have fortune tellers no more. I will cut off your carved images and your sacred pillars from among you, so that you will no longer bow down to the work of your own hands. I will root out your Asherim from among you, and I will destroy your cities, and I will execute vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations which have not obeyed me. When he does that, you can see then why the nations are all going to flow to Jerusalem and to the king who is in Jerusalem to go find out about this God who has that kind of power, who can do that kind of stuff through this ancient people group who we never gave up on. None of that has happened yet. And yet, as I said, Micah has this astounding batting average. Therefore, I assume it all is going to happen. It all does have to happen if the Bible is true. But if you come away with nothing else tonight, if you don't remember the details, and I know I'm going a couple minutes long, just remember, first off, that God in heaven is just not like us, and we're not like God. And his thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. He's very different than us. And therefore, he can control human history in ways that don't always seem like the best way to do it, or the way that we would do it, or a way that that follows the patterns that we would prefer. He is perfectly capable and willing to take people who he loves, who he has declared are his people, and he is their God, and yet he can punish them, and yet he can scatter them so that he can teach them. And then he will use them in order to punish the other people groups who have been long-standing enemies of his. And then he can establish those people and give them a time of peace. In history, he's given them times of peace and then brought more trouble on them and then taken them back through those times of tribulation and pain. And ultimately, there is a day coming when they're going to give birth. Ultimately, there is a day coming when there's an end to their trials and their tribulations and their birth pangs. And there is going to be an ultimate day of peace and prosperity for Israel. But he's accomplishing it through a pattern that right now we're living in a moment where Israel's going through a whole lot of trouble. And so the world looks at them and gloats, just like Micah said, and gloats at them and says, well, then God must be done with them. Even too much of the church world does that. And yet God says, despite all that, that he is going to keep his promises to them. He is going to regather them, and he's going to do it to demonstrate his power. He's going to do it to demonstrate that he is a faithful God who keeps his word no matter what. And notice, chief among it, he doesn't care what you think. The same way that he brings rain or puts dew on plants without any man participating, it's the same way that he's going to bring history to the ultimate end that he has described, and he doesn't need anybody's help. He doesn't care. It's all his. He's going to do what he said he's going to do because, as he said, he's declared it. Got it?
Yes.
You liking Micah so far?
Yes.
I don't mean that guy.
Nobody likes him.
Well, no, but... No, everybody likes him. So I hope you're seeing Micah speaks the same way the other prophets do. Sometimes people go, well, those are the minor prophets. But Isaiah is a major, major prophet, and he says the same thing Micah says at the same time. So there is this tremendous amount of attestation in the Old Testament that God just is not going to give up on Israel, despite what modern theologies and eschatologies might say. God doesn't care what men think. Comments, questions, feedback, outside of opinions on Micah. That Micah.
So. I have opinions on Micah.
You have a question about you? Okay.
I was reading some in Ezekiel, and this ties together. You talked about, you know, God proving that he's not done with Israel, the reiteration of that, you know, all of the prophets, and, you know, the prophecies about how evil their leaders were and how they strayed and how they were scattered, and, you know, even going back to seeing how they were wandering in the wilderness for 40 years before they came into the promised land, all that they had to go through. And you can rightly look at Israel even now, and it's very popular to do it now, and point to their faults and point to and say, well, they killed Christ. You know, they hate Christ, they hate Christians, they you know, gay pride parades in Tel Aviv, and so, you know, like, they're evil because of that. They're they spit on Christians, you know, it's because sometimes that happens over there. There's, you know, Epstein was a Jew, and so, you know, that's all tied together. Like, it is the nations pointing and saying that. Yeah. But it's so interesting to reading in Ezekiel when you really understand the big picture, that God's holiness is at stake here, and he's working in that people group as a way to demonstrate his holiness. And I'll just read it, Ezekiel 36, 22 and 23. I think, you know, that we need to demonstrate that more, that the name of God is at stake here, and that's really why he's doing all of this. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, not for the house of Israel, not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I'm about to act, but for my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations where you went. It's saying exactly what they're doing and what people will rightly point to. But I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst. And then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when I prove myself holy among you in their sight. So he's using that wickedness and that evil to prove himself holy, and that's how the nations are going to recognize and be taken back and be like, wow, that really is a holy God, because he was able to redeem this people that we all were pointing at and saying, how evil are they?
That's why the last couple of weeks I've been saying, you know, people are pointing at Israel right now and saying, look how bad they are. God must be done with them. Look how bad they are. And my question was, when were they ever good?
Exactly. Yes.
And yet God continues to promise that he's going to take care of them and redeem them. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing today is what history has always demonstrated of Israel. Mm-hmm. But God is holy, like you just said. And he will defend his own name. Let me ask you then, Micah. So then if people say God is done with Israel, what are they saying about God?
Well, that he doesn't keep his promises and he's not as holy as he says he is.
Yeah.
And he's changeable.
Yep. Yeah. And he'll give up on people.
Yeah, that doesn't give me much confidence.
That's bad news. Yeah. Well, if he can give up on people, I'm a goner.
Yep.
The only way I can understand the hatred against Israel, though, is a hatred against God.
Right. That's kind of why I was asking that question.
Honestly, as a nation, I've only seen them, and I lived over there, I've only seen them stand up for, I'm not saying God's righteousness, but like what they're doing with Iran, or standing up for the individual soldiers when they bring them back, the trades they make for, you know, thousands of terrorists being released to get one Israeli soldier back, or the hostages from October 7th. And my parents lived through World War II. I mean, this wasn't that long ago that the Jews didn't have their nation. And the World War II, in large part, was for this final solution against the Jews. It boggles my mind, after all that, and living through these times and the state of Israel being established, that I hear such anti-Semitism today.
I do understand it where the world is concerned. I mean, the world is going to continue to demonstrate and prove that God is right and that Israel is going to be hated without a cause and that that's all happening. The place that really boggles my mind is when supposedly Bible-believing Christian people join in on that. Mm-hmm. And then I go, what theology is this? What Bible are you reading?
Especially when we talk about a new covenant. A new covenant can only be based if there's an old covenant, which wasn't made with us. And if we consider ourselves to be part of a new covenant...
And who was the new covenant made with? The house of Israel and the house of Judah. Yeah. But they're not part of it anymore. Anything else? I'm glad we're all on the same page. I mean, those are all great comments.
And same Bible.
Same Bible. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.